Hello everyone and welcome. Today I'm joined by Radio 5 Live commentator John Murray, a legend of the business. He has tendered his voice to hundreds of iconic moments, which we discuss in today's podcast. Remember to follow on Spotify and subscribe on YouTube. Thank you. Hello and welcome to the channel or to Spotify, wherever you're listening to this. Hello and welcome. I'm Elliot and with me today I have Radio 5 Live commentator John Murray. Welcome to the channel.
Hi, Elliot.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on. I've been listening to Five Live for many, many years, and therefore I've been listening to your voice over so many different football and other sporting events.
Yes. Worryingly, I seem to be getting that increasingly, that I meet people who say I've been listening to you since I was at school. So that, I'm afraid, is just part of the years passing by quickly.
It's fantastic to speak to you, and across the course of this podcast we're just quite simply going to discuss your career, your highs, your lows, your favourite moments, and then towards the end we'll talk a little bit about the elephant in the room called coronavirus. So we'll start off, because there may be some people listening to this that may have not heard your voice or may not be too keen on listening to radio commentary. So just explain what you do, maybe how long you've been doing it, and just a few other bits like that.
Yeah, well, I commentate on most of the big matches that there are around, which is a great thing to be able to do. And I feel very lucky and very fortunate to have the job that I have, and it's a job that is thoroughly fulfilling. I find that even though I've been doing it now for best part 25 years plus, that I still find that it challenges me, and I find it enormously fulfilling as well as a job to do. Where I started was at doing a media course in journalism, radio journalism, and from there managed to get straight into local radio, where initially I was mainly focused on doing news and a bit of sport. And as the years passed by, I did more and more sport until I was in local radio at the BBC. So I started in commercial radio, then moved into BBC local radio. There began to specialise in sport, then moved to BBC national radio. And having originally worked as a producer, actually, in Radio Sport in London, I then managed to get myself onto the football commentary team, and that was around about 97 that I stepped up to the football commentary team. So, as you can see, that's best part of 25 years that I've been doing it. So lots and lots of match experience, lots and lots of big match experience, lots of tournament experience. My first World Cup that I commentated on was France 98. And I've done all of the tournaments, the World Cup, European Championship tournaments since then. So I'm a lucky boy.
Not to make you feel old or anything, but the World Cup 1998, I wasn't actually born. So just talk us through how that tournament went about for England and for yourself.
Well, that was a big thrill for me, because as I say, I only became a permanent member of the commentary team in 97, and obviously there was a World Cup just around the corner. So I found myself going to a World Cup at the end of my first season as a national radio commentator, which was brilliant. And in actual fact, it's only the last two tournaments that I've been the England commentator, or one of the England commentators, at the World Cup European Championship. Before that point, it was Mike Ingham and Alan Green who would commentate on England at the tournaments. So I had some experience of commentating on England, but it was when Mike stepped down in 2014 after the World Cup in Brazil that that I then stepped up and moved into Mike's role, which was football correspondent, and that's why I now cover all of the big matches, the finals that I do, because I moved into Mike's role. But back in 98, I was covering a wide variety of matches. In actual fact, I was just looking back the other day, my first match at a World Cup was Cameroon against Austria, of which I've got absolutely no memory whatsoever, but the general full experience of going to a World Cup for the first time, I mean, I've got lots of memories of that tournament. I was just absolutely wide-eyed. I loved it so much. And, I do as we'll probably discuss, I do cover a wide variety of not just football but other events. And for me, covering the World Cups and the European Championship tournaments is right at the top of the tree.
You mentioned just there that you have covered other sports, and you mentioned that the World Cup, blah blah blah, are the top of the list. What else is up there then for you?
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot up there, actually. The Open is, I cover golf on 5 Live for, I mean, football is my bread and butter. That's what I do 90-95% of my working year. And the rest is mainly taken up with golf. So I'll go to the Open. The Ryder Cup is such a brilliant event to work at on the radio. The Masters, if I can squeeze in a bit more golf, then I do that. Also involved in the Olympics. I've done a couple of Commonwealth Games as well, the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow. So I've commentated on opening ceremonies, commentated on the opening ceremony at London 2012, which was certainly one of my highlights. And then also what's always happened at BBC Radio, as I've been discovering just this week with the VE Day celebrations. And it's been the case, I think, throughout the history of radio sport, that whenever there are big occasions, big state occasions, very often the powers that be will draft in sports commentators to cover them. And that's been the case with me as well. So I commentated on the royal wedding when William married Kate, commentated on the Queen's last big jubilee. And you know, we find ourselves for the royal wedding. I had a position next to the cenotaph in Whitehall, commentating on what was happening there. And as I make reference, because I was listening to some of the coverage this week of the VE Day in 1945, and heard Stuart McFarlane, who was one of the early football commentators, was actually commentating on events in central London on that day in 1945. So I love doing that sort of thing, because I really enjoy a bit of variety, and I find that keeps me thinking and keeps me fresh in terms of the basic football commentary that I do.
So how does that differ then for your preparation for when you're actually doing it, compared to, let's say, when you're doing a Champions League game, compare that to doing a royal wedding?
Well, what I'm there for is to commentate, particularly if I'm doing radio. I do a bit of TV, so I occasionally appear on Match of the Day. But that's a very different discipline, even though you are still basically commentating on football matches. But from a radio commentary point of view, it is that basic thing of saying what you see and trying to make sure that anyone listening at any point has got a good idea of what's going on. So what it is that's important to know about the event that you're commentating on at any point. So that's the initial and most basic challenge. And then from there, it's all about putting layers on it. And as we always talk about, painting pictures with words and trying to transmit the atmosphere, colour and picture of what it is that you're watching. So whether you're commentating on a big football match, a small football match, or a royal wedding, those basics apply.
So we'll move on now onto your actual football history and the things that you've been through. And we're going to start off with one of my favourite games that I've ever, quite frankly, seen in the short amount of time that I've been watching football. Ajax against Tottenham in the Champions League. You were fortunate enough to actually be there to commentate on it 4-5 live. And I actually listened back to the commentary earlier. If I'm being honest, you've remained remarkably calm for that final goal by Lucas Moura to complete the comeback.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because thinking back to it, it was one of those occasions where I didn't feel entirely in control. And I've learned over the years that, there is a temptation when you get a really big match and a really exciting match and a really exciting outcome and a late goal, dramatic goal, that it is easy, even though it's been drummed into me over the years, very much something that we've always told about at the BBC, is to try and retain that impartiality. And at the same time, listen, I accept that in certain circumstances, if I'm commentating on football matches involving the home nations, if I'm involved in commentating on matches involving English clubs against European clubs in events like the Champions League or the Europa League, if I'm involved in big finals like that, I am aware of the fact that most of the people listening to our commentary will be wanting the in inverted commas home team to win. So therefore, you bear that in mind. But you do try to remain impartial, and you want to remain in control, because I found out through trial and error where you lose control. And so if you lose control of your voice and you lose control of your emotions, then the next step is that you lose control of your words. And that's not what you want as a commentator. So it's about trying to keep it all together there and reflecting the excitement and drama, such as we had in Amsterdam on that night when Tottenham came back and won. But keeping the control is important. But I mean, it's funny, you know, over the course of the last year and a half, 2 years or so, I feel as though we've seen so many dramatic and exciting matches that one has almost topped the other. And I did reach the stage, I think, last summer, where I was thinking, is it going to carry on like this? And I'd almost reached the point. I mean, I said to friends, I feel like I've almost reached the point where I've run out of superlatives, the old phrase. And isn't it funny how life goes, and that we end up where we are now, and you have an opportunity without football and without sport to really appreciate what it is that we did have. Thanks to a really hectic and dramatic period like that. So if there was a danger of being even slightly complacent about how fortunate and how lucky I'd been and we'd been to see so many dramatic games over that period, then this is a reminder of how we should really enjoy what we see at the time.
Yeah, you talk about dramatic moments there. And for me, as a relatively young football fan, I've not really seen much success for England ever, if I'm being quite honest.
Believe you me, Elliot, neither have I.
But the World Cup 2018, there's always been an argument that the run isn't as good as what people, you know, make it out to be because of the teams that England played. However, they did win on penalties in a World Cup knockout game, and you were there for that again against Colombia. Eric Dier scoring the winning penalty to send England through, to send us all into absolute ecstasy back home over in Russia. Just talk to us then about what the feeling in the stadium, and your feelings, of course, at the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the nights that I would certainly pick out as one of the highlights, one of my favourite memories from my years as a commentator so far. For a number of reasons, really. The whole England at the World Cup thing. And you're right, you know, you look back and see the teams that England were put up against at that World Cup, and but at a tournament like that, all you can do is take on who you put up against. And that game against Colombia was a tough match for England. You know, there was a different feeling about England. We all know how they changed their approach and how there was this much more approachable feel about the England squad at that time going into a tournament. So there was a lot of goodwill for England, and the way that they'd breezed through the group stage and then involved in that really tough game against Colombia, you know, for all sorts of reasons. Then it went to a penalty shootout. And as I was explaining earlier, you know, I am English. I'm therefore, as an Englishman, I want England to do well in a tournament. But at the same time, you try to maintain the balance. But you know, it had all been so good up to that point, and you know, Russia had been an amazing experience. And if you remember going into that tournament, you know, we all had genuine reservations about what it was going to be like there, and how we'd be treated, and how things would be, you know, and it had been it had been such a great experience up to that point. But it went down to the penalty shootout against Colombia to decide whether England were going to go through to the quarterfinals or whether they were going to go out again early at a tournament and go out again on penalties. I knew that in my role, I was going to have to go downstairs and do the interviews. And Gareth Southgate, who I had and have, you know, a good relationship with, you know, he is a genuinely good guy to deal with. I was going to go down there and ask him all the difficult questions and all the old questions about penalty shootouts, his own personal history going out in a penalty shootout, missing the penalty at Euro 96. I had Chris Waddle sitting next to me for the commentary, who famously missed a penalty at Italia 90, which knocked England out. There was so much wrapped up in that. And, you know, I felt such an emotional connection describing that penalty shootout that when it went England's way, you know, I think that if you ever listen back to that, you can certainly hear the relief in my voice and in what I say immediately after the outcome is decided there. So for that reason, it was a night, an occasion, and certainly a few moments when I felt differently then to any other time that I felt commentating in the job that I do.
Has anything ever lived up to that or got near to that level? Either since or before that night?
No, I would say. I had the feeling at half-time in the semi-final, I remember when England were 1-0 up on Croatia and had played well in the first half. I remember thinking at half-time, doing the thing you should never do, get ahead of yourself, and thinking, we're going to be commentating on England in a World Cup final on Sunday. Because this is going to go England's way, so lesson there: never get ahead of yourself. We know what happened. But in terms of an actual, I mean, I'm not a massive fan of penalty shootouts, you know, because I just think it's so much of a lottery. Mm-hmm. But you know, there has to be a way to decide games like that. You know, that's just reality. However, I mean, that was an unforgettable experience to say that. And I think until I see England do something to top that, even the club events that I've witnessed, you know, you talk about Tottenham and some of the other games that that we've had in recent times, so dramatic Champions League matches, Premier League matches, you know, I think that'll take some topping.
So we've gone through one of your highest moments that you've ever experienced in your career and also as a football fan, but let's try and talk about the lows, because in every career, no matter what part of life you're in, whether young or old, or no matter what industry you are in, you are going to go through tough times. You are going to go through lows. You are going to go through things that are going to happen that are going to make you react differently to certain things. So have you ever gone through anything or experienced anything that's been quite what you'd probably class as a low then in your career?
Well, I mean, I always remember my first news editor when I worked at TFM on Teesside. My news editor there, John Ogden, one of the early things he said to all of us was, he said, in this business, I mean, it's such a cliche, but it's absolutely true. He said, in this business, it is a roller coaster, and one minute you're up and the next you're down. Mm. And I think about that all the time, because it happens during the course of a year, during the course of a football season. Honestly, I find myself in this job. It's live broadcasting. You make mistakes all the time. Even though I've been doing it as long as I have, I make mistakes virtually every weekend. Things go wrong. Things happen that you don't expect, and you just have you just never finish learning. There's never a point in this job where you can afford to think that you've cracked it. Because of that, because you are every time I cover a football match, I'm making an unscripted performance of 90 minutes, and therefore you're not going to get everything right. You're not going to get everything. You're not going to see everything correctly. That's an important thing about being a commentator. You know, you miss things. You see things the wrong way. You call things. You know, you swear that so-and-so got the final touch on this. You see it again on the television in front of you and you realize that you were wrong. It happens. And what I find that you have to do is you just have to put it behind you. And it's amazing how often I find, say, on a weekend, if I'm covering a couple of matches one weekend, and things don't go well in either match, and I find myself driving home on a Sunday night thinking, that's you know, you've had a poor weekend there. You know, things have not gone well at all. And I often think, I wonder how I'll feel this time next week. And it's remarkable how, and I think it's the effect of that makes you raise your game for the next week ahead. And I find myself the next week at Sunday night driving home thinking, do you know what? That's gone pretty well the last couple of days. So that's what it is. You know, I think you have to remember as well, you know, remember what it is that we do. And it is what it is. You know, it's broadcasting. It's genuinely not life or death. No one gets hurt. You make mistakes, but you make them in good faith. So you just have to put it behind you. It's like, I love my cricket as well. And I did quite a lot of opening the batting. And I always think it's a little bit like that, in that when you get beaten outside the off stump, but you miss it, you do have to just put it behind you, and you have to think about the next ball.
Yeah, I very much like that analogy, and it's interesting to see how you've got to adapt to those situations and change the way that you're thinking and not panic under that situation. If something has gone wrong, or you've got something wrong, Lavanier, you've just got to get on with it, and you've just got to keep going and keep telling the listener what's happening, and keep telling them what you're seeing, and, you know, stay as professional as you possibly can. So it's incredibly interesting to see you here, to hear you discuss that.
Yeah. So and listen, I'm in the very fortunate position as well of knowing that there will be other opportunities.
Yeah.
So I know that, you know, if things haven't gone well one weekend, I know I'm going to be doing it again on the Wednesday and doing it again the next Saturday and the next Sunday. So I know I'm going to get the opportunities to put it right in a normal world.
Yeah. So we'll move on then finally to the final point that I really want to discuss today. And that's, as I said at the start of this, it is the elephant in the room. It's the coronavirus situation. There's no getting around it. It's here. We've all got to deal with it. However, football seems to be dealing with it in ways that no one really expected. Some leagues are just completely cancelling. Mm-hmm. Some leagues are just postponing. Like France, they've just ended their league, what would class as the halfway point, and they've said there's no sport in the country until September. Whereas England, no one really knows what's happening. The FA, whoever's trying to make the decisions, has stayed incredibly quiet on the situation. So I just want to know from your point of view, from your opinion, do you think the season should be cancelled? Do you think it should be null and voided? Basically, what do you think should be happening?
In an ideal world, I would like to see the season finished. And you've got a number of options here. As you say, you finish it and null and void it. You finish it as it is. You commit to finishing it in some form and concentrate on the next season. I think the difficulty here is that, you know, again, in an ideal world, I would like to see some lead given by UEFA on this, because for me, I think the reason I feel that the season should be finished is because of the uncertainty of what might happen in 3 months' time, 6 months' time with this. And that's why I feel that there should be a greater commitment to finishing the season. But I understand that because of the various pressures and influences, be they financial or otherwise, that UEFA are looking to get the leagues finished across Europe, because they have that focus on the starting of the next season. But I just think, because of that uncertainty, I think the ideal scenario would be to finish the leagues. But I mean, it's so complicated. As you say, you know, the Premier League are doing what they're doing. The EFL are taking a slightly different route. We might have League One and League Two finished as they are. You know, that might happen over the course of the next week. In the National League, talking about maybe trying to play just the playoffs there. So even in those leagues, I mean, look at what's happening in Scotland as well, where it's also all over the place. In the end, it will have to come down to the safety of the players and how they feel about it. I think is also going to be important over the course of the next couple of weeks or so. I think inevitably there is this mood to get the Premier League started by the beginning of by the middle of June. Wouldn't be at all surprised if that ended up being pushed back a little, depending on how things develop over the course of the next few weeks or so. And clearly what happens in Germany is going to be significant as well in terms of setting some sort of blueprint for what we do, and likewise Spain as well. So an awful lot tied up in it. And I think people are correct when they say that there is a safeguarding going on of the club's financial position. And again, I get that. I get it because of all of the associated interested parties that there are, and what it will mean down the line for people's jobs and their roles, what it will mean for the clubs themselves. And the clubs very often are such an important part of the community. But ahead of all of that, it is the safety aspect that is far and away the most important. And I'm afraid at the moment we're talking about this while we're still recording hundreds of deaths every day that are related to the virus. So that is your absolute starting point when it comes to deciding what to do and when to do it.
I'll try and play devil's advocate here and try and see two sides of the argument. So I see where you're coming from, where you're saying, you know, we need to get the season finished. Doesn't matter when we do it, but we need to get the season finished. But do you not also see the argument where if the season was just null and voided, by the time it all comes back, it's September, we just start afresh and everything is, you know, as it was before, and this season's a complete write-off?
Well, that's what we hope would happen, that we would be able to start the next season in September. But if we did start the next season in September, and then in October and November found ourselves in exactly the same position, then I think it would be tempting to reflect on why it was that we simply just didn't concentrate on finishing the season that we had in progress at the time. And then, however long that takes, then taking a start point from once all of the leagues are able to actually get completed. But, you know, I understand as well the integrity is a matter. You know, a league season is supposed to play between two certain dates, and you have all of the various conditions within that period of time. You know, some clubs have lost players to injury who wouldn't have played again this season. And with the timescale as it is now, a number of players now will be able to play. You know, so the parameters have been changed there. So I do understand that, but you know, it's just my own personal feeling is that you try and start what you finish, particularly when we've gone so far, two-thirds of the way, more than that, through the season, and try and get things sorted out as neatly as it is possible to do.
I've got to say, I am with you. The season, I'd like it to be finished, even if that is in 3 months' time. We need to keep that integrity. But at the end of the day, I don't think everyone is going to be pleased. There are going to be players that are going to be unhappy. They're going to be fans that are unhappy, no matter what the decision is, whether it's cancelled, whether it's postponed, whether it is finished behind closed doors or not. No matter what happens, not everyone is going to be happy. And I'm hoping that UEFA, FA, whoever's making the decisions, looks at that and just goes with what they think is the best decision to make, because at the end of the day, that is what they're going to be paid to do.
Yeah, and you've got complications lurking around every corner, however way you do this, complications, legal ramifications, however you work it out. So that's the tricky side of it as well. So good luck to them, because it's an absolute minefield.
I'm very glad that I'm not in their situation, not in their jobs, having to sort this out, because I wouldn't have a clue. And to be quite honest, I don't think they do. And that's what we've just got to hope they manage to work through. But that's it for today. So thank you very much for joining me, for discussing your career and, of course, the situation that is ongoing at the minute across the world. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Elliot. No, I've enjoyed it. I've got plenty of time on my hands at the moment. So anything to help pass the time is very welcome.
Super. So-